This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Billy Donovan certainly didn't need the money. The University of Florida men's basketball coach was about to sign a 7-year contract worth nearly $25 million. He didn't need the prestige. The Gators had just won their second consecutive championship, and the 42-year-old was one of the brightest stars in the constellation of college coaches. So it shocked many observers when Donovan announced last week that he had signed a contract to become the new coach of the NBA's Orlando Magic. The decision also apparently shocked Coach Donovan, so he changed his mind. Joining me on the line to wade through all this is ESPN.com columnist Pat Forty. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Good to be here.
A coach changing his mind isn't new, but a college coach rejecting the NBA, that's got to be a violation of some sort of bylaw somewhere, right?
Yeah, because they all want to go up to that pro level, it seems, a level where they really don't perform well. But it was very surprising to see Billy turn down the money and the challenge of something that he felt like he could do after succeeding as well as he did in college. And I mean, I have to say, I think that in the end, he got it right. I think that it was a very bad decision by him to go to the NBA, and in the end, he changed his mind and came to his senses.
Well, the NBA was not entirely happy with the reversal. It seemed as if the Magic and the league took Donovan's about-face rather personally. The deal that freed the coach to return to his college job included a 5-year non-compete clause that will prevent him from coaching in the NBA during that time. Why not just tear up the contract, shake hands, and let bygones be bygones?
You know, I think that, first of all, they were very put off by the way Billy did, go through and physically sign the contract and do the press conference and then turn around 3-4 days later. And I think that maybe this is a preemptive strike trying to say, you know what, this seems to be a bit of an advancing trend in coaching, especially with college coaches where you agree to something and then you change your mind. And it's not going to fly in the NBA. I think that was the bottom line there, that, the Magic felt burned, and the NBA wanted to make sure that they don't get burned in the future.
Billy Donovan may have made the smart move, as you began to suggest a minute ago. The NBA landscape is littered with the carcasses of college coaches, Mike Montgomery, John Calipari, Tim Floyd, Rick Pitino, at least as he performed in Boston, who thought they could make the jump to the NBA. Why is that transition so hard?
You know, I think a couple of things. First of all, most college coaches that succeed are good recruiters and motivators. Those two clubs are out of your bag, if you will, at the NBA level. You know, motivation is generally, it counts on coming from the players. It's not, the guys, they're not going to respond to, rah-rah speeches. Most of them make more money than college coaches. College coaches like to have a lot of control, and those guys, they're not going to be in control in those situations. And the other thing is they go out and recruit players and generally get the rosters they want. And most of these guys have stepped into situations where they don't have good players, and it's up to the front office to get them. And it's a little bit harder in the NBA, given the salary cap, to just go out and get new guys every year. So I think there's kind of a compilation of things. But you're right, the track record is pretty dismal.
Based on what you've said about motivation, it strikes me that a college coach coming to a pro team that was overwhelmingly young might have a better shot. But that's just a guess. What has caused some college coaches to succeed at the pro level?
I think that you do have to get into the right situation. You get a coachable star, for one thing, and then you can put some other pieces around him, then, you can see succeed. It's not like Rick Pitino can't coach. It's not like John Calipari can't coach, but they made some poor personnel decisions. They didn't handle the losing aspect of it very well. But if you get in the right spot, like Pitino did with the Knicks, you can succeed.
In part because the turnover in college ball is so quick. Sometimes guys just go to school for a year or two and then go to the NBA. The biggest stars in college basketball are often the coaches, but in the NBA it's the players that are on the marquee. Do college coaches with large egos just find that too tough to handle?
I think that's part of the equation, definitely, because you're right that the coaches are the stars of the show in college, and everything's kind of geared toward them. There are, players can't get endorsements, so the coaches get all of those. And there's, 25 sideline shots per game of the coaches. And, most of the commentators are friendly with the coaches, and so they will, preach or sing their praises endlessly. I think that the different dynamic of the pros is difficult for a lot of them to handle because, they are prop. Mike Brown, who cares about who Mike Brown is? You know, it's LeBron James and the Cavaliers, and it's Tim Duncan and the Spurs. It's not Greg Popovich, so it's a completely different dynamic.
This is leading me to think that maybe Texas Tech's Bob Knight and Duke's Mike Krzyzewski are even smarter than people have been telling me for years that they are, because they've turned down lots and lots of offers to coach in the pros and stay in the college ranks.
Oh, yeah. I think, it's good to be king, and they are definitely kings of their respective kingdoms. And could you imagine Bob Knight trying to get his act to fly in an NBA locker room? I think he's smart enough to know that he's in the right place for him.
Coach Donovan claimed that he realized after signing the contract with the Magic that he belonged in college basketball. How long before attorneys acting on his behalf try to get that 5-year ban overturned so he can change his mind again?
Well, I talked to Billy this week, and he came across very sincerely saying that, he's fine with the 5-year ban because he knows that college is where he wants to be, but you never say never with these guys. And, the one thing is he is friendly with Pat Riley, and Pat Riley's not going to coach forever at the Heat, and who wouldn't want a chance to coach Dwayne Wade? So it's not out of the question. But for now, I will go along with his sincere pitch that he is in college for the foreseeable future.
Pat Forte is a national columnist for ESPN.com, and he does that wholeheartedly, I'm quite sure. Pat, thanks again.
All right, thank you, Bill.
The Philadelphia Phillies lost to the Kansas City Royals last night, meaning the franchise has lost a total of 9,986 games. Sometime in the next few weeks, the Phillies will become the first Major League Baseball team, and possibly the first pro team in any sport, to lose 10,000 games. The Phillies say they aren't planning to recognize this dubious achievement, but some fans are taking matters into their own hands. From WHYY in Philadelphia, Joel Rose reports.
At a VFW hall in suburban Willow Grove, just north of Philadelphia, about a dozen Phillies fans are watching the game over pitchers of Yingling Lager.
One run, I'll
score!
It's the bottom of the ninth, and the Phillies are down by a run. They have a man on second when slugger Ryan Howard steps to the plate. Howard crushes a line drive right into the second baseman's glove.
Oh, yes!
Oh, damn it.
Shut up! Shut up! Find a way to break my heart. Every different time. I keep
Why?
Coming up with new ways, man. Keep coming up
that?
With new ways.
And just like that, loss number 9,983 is in the books. Bobby Winter says he's probably watched thousands of those losses at this bar.
When they get close, you expect them to lose. You always expect the worst to happen because it always does.
Well, almost always. The Phillies did win the World Series in 1980, but except for a handful of pennants over the years, that's about all they've won. Now the team is on the verge of 10,000 losses, easily the most in Major League history. Yet for Charlie DeBoe Jr., this is something to celebrate.
It's not a bad thing. It's not that I'm celebrating the fact that you guys are losers. I'm celebrating the fact that us as fans have stuck around you while you've been losers all these years.
DeBoe runs a website called Celebrate 10,000. The motto is Real Fans, that's fans with a PH, love their losers. The site sells T-shirts and pint glasses. It's also a forum for fans to share their favorite memories of the Phillies. Inevitably, a lot of the stories involve disappointment. And for sheer futility, nothing beats 1964.
1964 was slow, painful, agony. The unbelievable happened.
That's Charlie DeBoe Sr. He was 17 years old in 64 when the Phillies blew a 6.5-game lead with just 10 regular season games left to play.
It was devastating. Devastating to me personally. Devastating to the city. I mean, the whole town was in a funk.
One of the younger guys in the bar asks DeBoe how that collapse compares with the 1993 World Series, which the Phillies lost to the Toronto Blue Jays on a walk-off home run by Joe Carter.
The 93 was decapitation with a guillotine,
and 64 was decapitation with a butter knife.
It might even match something that's going on down at Guantanamo. I don't know, man. It was pretty bad.
Arguably, the Phillies have been bad more often than anybody else. Dave Jordan wrote a book about the Phillies, published in 2002, called Occasional Glory. Jordan says the team finished at the bottom of the National League standings in its very first season, way back in 1883.
The Phillies were up against it right from the start with tough competition and a bad team. And that's kind of been the story of their career. But, you know, negative or not, bad teams or not, Philadelphia has always supported baseball. Philadelphia is a good baseball town.
After 124 years of unconditional support from the fans, Charlie DeBoe Jr. is calling on the Phillies organization to make some official gesture of thanks.
It's about recognizing something that can't be disregarded. It's a magical number. I mean, it's 10,000. 10,000 losses. I want to feel that you guys actually came out and from the heart made us feel, you know what, this team does care about us.
At their current rate, the Phillies will lose their 10,000th game sometime in early July. But the team is planning to treat that game like any other. Team Vice President Larry Schenk says there's no way the team will do anything official to mark the occasion.
I don't know of any team other than the Washington Generals who played the Globetrotters who celebrated losses. So it's going to come. We know it. It's sort of like taxes and death. It's going to be there.
Schenk points out that a few other franchises are creeping toward 10,000 losses, namely the Atlanta Braves, who started out in Boston, and the San Francisco Giants, who moved from New York. Outside the park before a recent home game, the fans were putting on a brave face, too. Rich Wysocki of Ridley Park says 10,000 is just a number.
It's just a point in time. You know, they could hit their 10,000th loss and still win the World Series the same year. It doesn't really matter.
The fans will come back to the ballpark no matter what, says Fred Stewart of Center City.
We are masochists, we Phillies fans. We have to be. It's what keeps us coming back.
For Only a Game, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a celebration of a horse unprepared for the Belmont Stakes or the Kentucky Derby or the Preakness, for that matter, who became a five-time champion. But first, in the women's final of the French Open today, Justine Henin will face Anna Ivanovic in a men's final that must have some observers wondering why the tournament bothered with all those preliminary rounds. Roger Federer, the world's best player on every surface but clay, will face Rafael Nadal, who never seems to lose on clay. Nadal has won the last two French Opens. Federer has won everything else. This year's French Open was exceptionally unkind to U.S. players, most of whom departed the tournament during the first week of play. Serena Williams was, for a time, the exception. Shortly before she became the final U.S. player to tumble out of the tournament, Williams, who at least made it to the quarterfinals before being squashed by Justine Henin, 6-4, 6-3, said of the surface upon which the French Open is played, "I really like this clay." Ms. Williams continued, "I like to slide on it, and I'm getting good at it. You have to slide. I've been sliding in my dreams."
Direction off, remote, we're good.
Among those most likely to have been delighted by that sentiment is Larry Sack, the director of tennis at Rhode Island's Todd Morcilli Tennis Center. Larry Sack presides over Rhode Island's only public clay courts and attributes the relatively poor performance of U.S. players at tournaments played on clay to lack of experience on the soft stuff.
The rest of the world, which is currently ahead of the United States in tennis, South America and Europe, they're predominantly learning on a clay court surface. You need to activate your brain more on the clay courts. You don't just win with power. So the health benefits that you get cardio-wise, which they've always known for years that tennis was a great sport for your heart, it's also a great sport for your brain, and you get to use your brain more when you're playing on clay.
Sack's contention is that points played on a hard court too often begin and end with a booming, unreturnable serve. Clay, a slower surface, favors the player who is steady, patient, and crafty rather than merely powerful. Hence, Larry Sack is happy that all 10 of the courts here in Roger Williams Park are clay, which he maintains is rarely the case at public facilities.
In Rhode Island, these are the only public clay courts. In New England, I believe there's two other facilities that have public clay courts. It's hard to communicate this on radio, but this is a very special location. Beautiful ancient trees around you, and this very beginning way to learn tennis. Tennis was invented on clay courts and on soft surfaces like grass.
Larry Sack gets no argument from the people playing at his facility on this spring afternoon, though some of them, Ken Dion, for example, appreciate the clay courts for reasons that have nothing to do with aesthetics or history.
If you're playing a hard court, you play twice a week, you feel like you've been beat up by four guys. You come over here, you can play four times a day. You can play forever on the clay. It doesn't hurt your body.
Ken Dion should know. He's been playing tennis for more than 25 years, mostly on these clay courts. His friend Bill Bradley, no relation to the tall former presidential candidate, is also a clay court player. He especially appreciates the surface after a recent hip replacement.
It's soft. It doesn't take the pounding that a hard court does.
I'm going to be curious about whether the surgeon who did your hip said, yeah, you can go back play tennis, but stay off that hard stuff.
No, he said to come back and see him next week.
Amy, we're going to do a ball pickup, go back into the ball machine, take water if you need it. We're going to do another round of this.
At the other end of the long row of courts, from where Dion and Bradley have been chatting, Larry Sack and his assistant, Amy McDevitt, have gathered a class of adult novices.
So when it's your turn, it's going to be hit, recover, hit, recover, hit, recover.
A good time is apparently being had by all, a better time, in fact, than some of the people with sore knees, bad backs, or tender feet might be having on hard courts. After the lesson, Larry Sack explains how these comfortable courts fell out of fashion.
Simply put, it was a matter of ease of use, but it's much easier for a municipality to take the paving crew that does the streets and do the hard courts that way. So there has been a changeover in the United States toward hard court tennis. But I think the soft stuff's coming back. I know the Hall of Fame is doing well with their grass courts. They're also open to the public. And this facility, we're growing by leaps and bounds year in and year out. This is year three for us running this, and we're seeing exponential growth of people wanting to come out and play on the clay.
Demand notwithstanding, the number of clay courts at the Roger Williams Park is unlikely to increase, given that the tennis center abuts the zoo, which is Rhode Island's number one tourist attraction. Still, it's pleasant to assume that Larry Sack is right and that future public courts in New England and elsewhere might be made of soft, forgiving clay. It would be easier on the joints, which is good for the group Sack refers to as the post-40 crowd, and it might also help a U.S. player or two in the next generation of competitors to get beyond the quarterfinals of the French Open. This afternoon marks the 139th running of the Belmont Stakes. Among the competing horses will be the Preakness winner, Curlin, and Rags to Riches, a brilliantly successful filly making her first start against males. Lots of arguments about which thoroughbred horse was the greatest of them all will begin with discussions of the Triple Crown. Surely one of the horses that has won the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont Stakes must be the best of them all. In Kelso, the Horse of Gold, Linda Kennedy challenges that assertion, contending that success over time should count for more than three triumphant afternoons during a single racing season. Linda Kennedy joins me now from the studios of Maine Public Broadcasting in Augusta to make the case for Kelso. Ms. Kennedy, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Let's get Kelso's credentials out front at the start. This champion was voted Horse of the Year five consecutive times. Put that achievement in context for us.
Sure. In all of history, there have been few horses, really, that have been voted Horse of the Year two times. Forgo, on the other hand, was elected Horse of the Year three times. And that really is the record, with the exception of Kelso. And what that means is that for 5 years in a row, Kelso took on the best of every horse of every generation, including the Triple Crown winners in the fall of the year, and every year he beat them. And he really was the best horse in the country 5 years in a row. To put it in another context, I would say, it would be the equivalent. He won what was, in his day, the championship race of the year. and that was before the Breeders' Cup. The race was called the Jockey Club Gold Cup.
Mm-hmm.
It was run at the today unheard of distance of 2 miles. Kelso won that race 5 years in a row, broke the American record, broke his own American record, set 2 track records and another track record at Belmont Park in doing so. And it would be the equivalent in modern times of a horse winning the Breeders' Cup Classic 5 times in a row. And that's a feat, I think, that would be unlikely to ever happen again.
You had and have what you feel is a personal connection to Kelso. Tell us about that.
Well, like many girls my age, I think I was passionate about Kelso. We were fans. In my case, it came about in a very unusual way. I was really a fan of American racing history. And my attraction to Kelso came from that attraction to racing history. I honestly believe that even at an early age, I saw him for what he was. So it wasn't just the passion of a girl for a horse, but I think it was an understanding of the historic significance of what he was accomplishing and basically doing the same heroic deeds that all the stories of old I had read about in black and white photos had done.
Kelso was exceptionally successful from the time he was an old 3-year-old until he was almost 9 years old.
Correct.
But where was Kelso when he was a young 3-year-old, the age when horses compete in the Triple Crown races?
Well, in truth, Kelso was late to get started that year. He was actually wintering on a farm in Maryland most of that year. And as his trainer, Carl Hanford, who's still alive today, says, he probably galloped there some, but he really hadn't begun training at the time. And this was, I believe, already February. So at a time when most of the Triple Crown contenders are already beginning to run their prep races, Kelso really hadn't even begun training for that year. He was very slow to develop, very immature as a young 3-year-old, and he was simply too light in weight. Nobody had considered him a contender, and nobody ever nominated him for the race.
Once they did start thinking about Kelso as a racehorse, there was a problem because nobody really wanted to ride him, I guess, at the start. He was that obstreperous.
Well, he was. He was. For his exercise riders, he was. Carl Hanford took over the job when Kelso was a young 3-year-old. Just about that time that I told you about when he was wintering in Maryland. What Carl Hanford recognized right away was pretty wonderful. He actually took me to the place where it happened on the training track. A lot of horses they'll wheel. They're literally spinning a circle on their way to the racing track because they don't want to run in their workouts. What Kelso would do is he would run like heck, and as soon as he was done running and the riders pulled him up, he would wheel in the opposite direction as though he wanted to go back and run some more. He'd throw the reins over his head to one side, and then he'd flip his riders. And it was very hard. It was almost a daily occurrence. And so a lot of the riders didn't want to ride him. And as a result, really the newest, lightest rider on the farm by default was the rider that was given the task, and he was really the one that was least prepared for it.
You are among a number of people writing about successful racehorses who have invested those horses with human qualities, courage, for example, playfulness sometimes. Did you do that from the first time you had any acquaintance with Kelso?
I probably did because I was a child. And I have to say, even in the writing of the book, I think I was reacquainted and probably gathered an additional respect for it than I even had as a child. Through a child's eyes, it was very romantic. Through the eyes of an adult, it became very real and equally honest, I think. One of the things with Kelso that it's very hard to do is to use one adjective to describe him, because it really would depend on the race. To say he was courageous, I think, was certain. There was no question that's anthropomorphic. On the other hand, he was never going to let another horse get by him. So put that any way you want, through a horse's eyes, you know, or through anthropomorphic eyes, he wasn't about to let another horse get by him if he could help it. And that was the horse in him.
Kelso died in 1983 at the age of 26, but shortly before his death, he returned briefly to the racetrack a final time. Tell us about that day.
Oh, a glorious day. Kelso, as you said, was 26 years old. He had been invited to lead the post parade for the Jockey Club Gold Cup. It was the race he owned, that crowning event of 2 miles that he owned. And he and Forgo, another great gelding of the past, were invited to lead the post parade. And Kelso was dressed as he had always been, with a little yellow ribbon in his hair. And he rose to the occasion. He was described by the venerable Joe Hirsch as looking radiant and proud, bowing his head to the fans as he went by. And when Kelso stepped onto the track, the crowd just exploded, as it had when Kelso had walked onto the track every time for every final race that last year he ran. And the beauty of it all is he just ambled down the track, this proud old horse. He kept drifting toward the rail near the fans, and so he understood their appreciation. And as he was leaving the track, he paused at the winner's circle and started to smell the flowers that were basically protruding from the edge of the winner's circle, walked off the track for the final time. But I actually have a photo that shows that at one point he broke into a spry jog. I have a photo of him jogging that day, and it was brief, I'm sure. But the fans just broke into a roar of applause for him.
Linda Kennedy is the author of Kelso, The Horse of Gold, published by Westholm. She joined me from the studios of Maine Public Broadcasting in Augusta. Linda, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, you're very welcome, Bill. Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game. The Anaheim Ducks defeated the Ottawa Senators 6-2 on Wednesday night, and now the Stanley Cup has taken up residence in Southern California for the first time. Here to recap the series is the LA Times' Helene Elliott, who covers hockey from the Golden State. Helene, what has the local reaction been to this unprecedented occurrence?
Hell has frozen over, I guess, you know?
Literally.
It's been pretty enthusiastic. I mean, the crowd the other night, the night that they clinched it, was just terrific. They were on their feet for almost the whole game. They were really enthusiastic. It was just a great atmosphere. It really was.
The city of Anaheim enjoyed the Angels 2002 World Series win and 8 Lakers championships in the neighborhood in the last 30 years. Where do you think the Ducks' achievement will rank after the excitement has died down a little bit?
Well, you know, as much of a booster of hockey as I am, I mean, I have to be realistic, and it's certainly not going to have the impact of a Laker championship or an Angel championship. I mean, there are people who still don't believe the Angels won, and with good reason. I mean, that was just kind of, you know, every good force and karma and all those things coming together, and I doubt that it ever will again, frankly. But, you know, for hockey here, it's going to be a good thing. And if it inspires the Kings to try and get a little bit better, that's even going to be that much better, because to have two strong teams here, I think, would really be terrific. And to even have maybe the Kings and the Ducks playing each other in a playoff series, that, I think, would be the best thing that could happen for hockey here.
Still, a tough time over the last few years for hockey traditionalists. The Stanley Cup has been in Tampa Bay, Carolina, now Anaheim. Is it ever going to get north again?
Well, get some good general managers and get some good players and get a good coach, and maybe it will. I'm tired of hearing this stuff of, oh, hockey doesn't belong in Southern California, and they don't really appreciate it in these areas. Well, are you supposed to just automatically award it to the Bruins? Or,
yeah.
Well, maybe you'd like that, but, I mean,
yeah.
You know, the Chicago Blackhawks, you're supposed to automatically award it to them? I mean, come on, that would be absurd. That's like, you know, rewarding words for ignoring and neglecting that team for years and years and years. Please, these teams have earned it. Get over it.
Helene Elliott covers the NHL for the Los Angeles Times, and she talks about hockey with me during the NHL season, which, sadly, is now at an end. Have a good off-season, Helene.
You too, eh?
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid, GNC, and Duane Reade. This is NPR, National Public...
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Chicago's Hombres Peligrosos y Misteriosos. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's in NPR's New York Bureau, for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
I don't know if you're presently wearing your NASCAR hat. If you are, this would be the appropriate time to tip it, as I ask you to say a few words about Bill France Jr., who died on Monday at the age of 74.
He was at the age of 74, and still people referred to his father as Big Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure. The man who brought NASCAR to the position where it is right now, which is to say in places like Arizona and New Hampshire, the absolute final authority of all things stock car, and a guy who saw a wild and completely unpredictable, in the sense of nobody could predict it, expansion of a sport that was regional and is now no more southern than the National Hockey League is Canadian.
The San Antonio Spurs surprised almost nobody with their easy handling of the Cleveland Cavaliers on Thursday night. Was that prelude to a sweep?
No, I think the Cavaliers will come back and get one for the home folks. I think they lose this in five. If somehow LeBron James were able to carry this collection of rodeo clowns to an NBA title, it would be a greater thing than Michael Jordan ever did when he had Bill Cartwright at center. It just isn't going to happen. San Antonio's been in this position too many times before. Tim Duncan is still probably the best player in the league. They've got Bruce Bowen to thug it up. Jupiter is aligning with five games at this point. It's enormously, enormously predictable.
Speaking of the Cavaliers, Ohio's governor, Ted Strickland, has gone on record as supporting a gigantic billboard of King James. The federal government wants the billboard removed because it's 2.5 times the maximum size allowed near interstate highways. But Governor Strickland says, and I quote, "There's something spiritual about this presentation." Exactly when did a photo of a basketball star and a Nike swoosh become, quote, spiritual?
Oh, about $90 million ago, I would say. yes, I mean, it's very spiritual in the same sense that the giant Buddhas that got blown up in Afghanistan was. You build something big enough and it becomes sacred. It's the American way.
Charlie, my understanding of the NBA draft has been that after
it's
Greg
profound.
Oden and Kevin Durant, nobody else matters. So how did Kevin Durant so suddenly drop from very desirable to utterly suspect?
Well, because a lot of people seem to think the NBA is a weightlifting contest.
Uh-huh.
He went to what the NBA has for a combine and failed to bench press or otherwise lift 185 pounds, which makes people wonder if he... whether or not he could stand up to the pounding of an 82-game season, considering he's going to be playing probably a forward position. It doesn't devalue him enough to push him out of the top two. As his coach Rick Barnes said, there are lots of guys who can lift weights who can't play dead in a cowboy movie.
I like that, too. I think that's very good. The Orlando Magic named Stan Van Gundy their head coach on Thursday, Charlie. How much of Mr. Van Gundy's salary does Billy Donovan, whom Mr. Van Gundy replaced, have to pay?
Oh, I don't think any. I think this worked out for everyone, the best for all concerned, although I was rather amused at Billy Donovan's sudden discovery that when he took the job in Orlando that he had children, which I thought was remarkable. Oh, wait, I have children.
I better stay here.
I have to watch them play Little League. I have to stay where I am now. I'm sorry. They get this. I'm sorry. This eluded me somehow. Anyway, Stan Van Gundy's a really good NBA coach. Orlando got the best possible alternative to the guy they wanted.
You have spoken in the past about how ineffective Gene Upshaw has been at securing the rights, health, and safety of the members of the National Football League Players Union. Now he's threatening to break Hall of Fame guard Joe Delamalleur's neck. What did Mr. Delamalleur do to irk Mr. Upshaw?
Well, he intimated that the union has done far less than it should have in addressing, among other things, the myriad health issues afflicting people who played in the NFL in a less enlightened age, and he's absolutely right about that. The idea that we're just now coming to address the effects of post-concussion syndrome and everything else, let alone the fact that everybody who played in the NFL for longer than 10 years has two plastic knees and two titanium hips. Gene Upshaw is a creature of management. He always has been. That's the way management wants it. And for all of Roger Goodell's wonderful noises about how they're really going to take care of this problem, appointing another task force and having Gene Upshaw agree with you in doing so is not addressing the problem. It's talking about the problem.
Since Street Smart, the winner of the Kentucky Derby, did not win the Preakness, the number of people paying attention to today's Belmont Stakes is considerably smaller than it would otherwise have been, but I'm sure you're paying attention, and you know which horse is going to win, right?
Well, as you know, Bill, prior to being Mr. NASCAR, I was Mr. Horse Racing.
I didn't know that. I'm thrilled to learn it.
That was before I got my driver's license. And so using my highly scientific method and my buyer speed figures and my deep knowledge of breeding going all the way back to equipoise, I'm going to pick the horse with my initials, C.P. West.
Oh, excellent.
Even though I'm East.
Over the years, lots of cities hosting the Olympics have been accused of all sorts of bad behavior in preparation for the Games. But if the Geneva-based Center on Housing Rights and Evictions has its numbers right, China is going to set the world record for dislocations.
1.5 million people will be moved or otherwise shuffled off so the world can have its quadrennial track meet. Please, somebody covering this Olympics, point out in at least one story that the Olympics aren't worth discomforting a million and a half people. This is not an event worth all this bother. Please don't bid on it anymore.
Here's my candidate for most shocking sports headline of the week. Tour de France director can't guarantee clean race.
No!
Shocked.
No! Is he just sort of giving up lying about it, too, or what? Lie to us, please! I don't know if I can go on with this.
Troy Ellerman, who says journalists hounded him for transcripts of testimony in the Balco case, is now facing prison for leaking those documents. Does the identification of the attorney, Mr. Ellerman, as the source of the leaks mean Mark Feneruwada and Lance Williams are off the hook?
Apparently not. What they're being pursued for is the fact that they actually had the grand jury stuff. Mr. Ellerman sounds like a real prize. These guys put themselves on the line for 2 years, and now he's blaming them for getting him in trouble for leaking the testimony. But, you know, the journalism in this story has been right on the edge the whole way. And if you are going to lie down with this particular dog, you are going to wind up getting up with all kinds of fleas.
Roger Clemens pitches tonight for the Yankees. No, he doesn't. Which is it?
I don't know. I'm still shocked about the Tour de France. Is his groin now no longer fatigued?
I hate it that a groin is national news. The state of someone's groin should be a private matter.
I don't know. I don't understand why we have to know it's tuckered out. I really don't.
Me neither. Gary Sheffield of the Detroit Tigers said this week that he meant nothing derogatory toward Latin players when he said recently that Major League Baseball found it easier to control Latinos than black players. Any chance he gets away with that non-apology?
Oh, absolutely not, because he was being an idiot. This was a hassle nobody needed to have, and I don't care how real Sheff wants to keep it. He said something stupid. It was exactly what he believed, and nobody's going to believe his apology.
Actor Rob Lowe got a birdie during a celebrity golf tournament last weekend, and he really wishes that he hadn't. Discuss.
This is an interesting thing. Not only did he literally kill a bird in mid-flight with one of his shots, he killed a goldfinch. And not only did he kill a goldfinch, but by killing the goldfinch, he killed the state bird of Iowa.
Do it right.
This is the worst problem Rob Lowe has had with a video camera since 1988, and we're not going to get into that
one. I wouldn't.
But he apparently took it in good grace if the bird didn't, and made a joke saying that that was his birdie for the day. Ha ha.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
An unclean Tour de France. How will I go on?
Hit them straight, sure and far. Right on the grooves, strong and hard. The best of good luck be your fate. May you always hit 'em straight.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
Get 'em straight, sure and far, right on the grooves, strong and hard. The best of good luck be your fate. May you always get 'em straight. Always.
hit them straight.
Lucha Libre wrestling has been a staple of Mexican sports culture for decades. During the sport's golden age in the 1950s and 60s, the masked men were kings of the ring and could be seen in comic books, movies, and on TV for the match of the week. Today, luchadores, as they're called, are drawing fans in the United States, with weekly matches in California, Colorado, and Texas. In Chicago, a new company is promoting local talent to go head-to-head with their legendary counterparts south of the border. Yolanda Perdomo has the story.
At Cicero Stadium, an announcer greets spectators as they make their way to the grandstands and dozens of ringside seats.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're 5 minutes away from our start. People are still coming in. As soon as everyone is in, we'll start the show.
Actually, that's the show before the show, which includes an Elvis impersonator singing his greatest hits, followed by a 9-piece mariachi band. Eric Herman is president of EMLI, the Empresa Mexicana of Lucha Libre International, a Chicago-based company that manages over 30 local wrestlers to compete against superstars from Mexico. Herman says giving the people a little extra is what Lucha Libre is all about.
So for respect to our people, we have to put a show before to start the match, because it's very important to keep the people happy there in the business, you know. Maybe, you know, the ladies doesn't care about the matches, but maybe they like the mariachis show or the Elvis show or the Aztec dancers show. So that's why, because we try to put some event very interesting for the people.
While the mask is still the hallmark of Lucha Libre, one Chicago wrestler, El Gringo Loco, says he doesn't need one because, as he puts it,
no, it's because I'm very handsome. It's impossible for me to wear a mask.
Not surprisingly, people love to hate El Gringo Loco. Entering the arena in Stars and Stripes spandex, he taunts the predominantly Latino crowd by throwing out tortillas, only to have them thrown back at him. Gringo Loco's alter ego is 21-year-old Charlie Santo. He's been wrestling Lucha Libre and American-style wrestling for the past 8 years and says Lucha Libre is unique in that it has both style and substance.
American wrestling, there's more comical in Lucha Libre, more comedy, more fun, more entertainment value of it, whereas in American wrestling, it's just these big jacked-up monsters who don't really have a lot of talent. In American wrestling, a lot of people go just to see freaks of nature, if you will. Like in WWF or WWE, you know, it's more of a freak show, if you will. Here it's more entertainment and more of a show.
That comes in the form of acrobatic leaps and landings, as well as intricately detailed costumes that complement the masks. With names like Psychosis, Angel of Death, and Charlie Manson Jr., most Lucha Libre fighters present a nefarious image. But Chicago's El Pato Loco, or Crazy Duck, looks like a cross between Tweety Bird and Donald Duck. A big orange bill protrudes from his mask, and his baggy yellow pleather pants are held up by suspenders. Unlike Gringo Loco, he's a crowd favorite, especially with the children. Pato is from Mexico, but has lived in Chicago for 20 years, working for a maintenance company. He started Lucha Libre Wrestling 2 years ago.
I don't have a special move. The thing is, my special move is to see the faces happy, smiling for the kids. That's my special move for me. People call my name. That's made me so happy.
The shows combine acrobatic and athletic prowess, and for Latinos living in the United States, Lucha Libre is also a connection to their culture. Jesus Torres is from Mexico and has lived in Chicago for several years. He says watching Lucha Libre in this country fosters a great sense of pride for his countrymen.
It's a sport that the Mexican culture enjoys because it demonstrates attitude. It demonstrates power from one fighter to another. The rivalry between the good and the bad guys, like the battle between good and evil itself.
Next to soccer, Lucha Libre is the biggest spectator sport in Mexico. Torres adds that for many people like him, It's like bringing a slice of Mexico to enjoy in the U.S.
Many people who've lived in the United States for years, to bring this type of event, they remember memories of the movies, which were popular a long time ago. Santo, of Mil Mascaras, of Blue Demon. A lot of Mexican people come to remember and to forget for a little while about their problems at work, and they feel as if they were back home. And that's what's most important, to feel as if they're in an arena in Mexico.
While Lucha Libre is well known throughout Latin America, people in the U.S. are now getting a taste of Mexican-style wrestling outside the ring, thanks to Mucha Lucha, which airs on the Cartoon Network, and Nacho Libre, the Jack Black comedy in which Phil Janis first saw Lucha Libre. He drove from the northwestern suburb of Rolling Meadows, Illinois, with his two sons to see their first ever live lucha show in April.
It's interesting. It's a spectacle. It's eye candy. Just because it's more fam- to me, it's more family. You look around, there's children of every age. I mean, it's family.
As to whether the sport will catch on with American audiences, only familiar with offerings from the WWE, Janis is sure that if you showcase it, they will come.
Yes, if they come to it, yes, because I'm enjoying it. And I don't see why you wouldn't. It's a good family. It's good to come with the family.
The EMLLI says the success of April's Cicero Stadium Showdown, which was taped to air on Azteca America's Gladiadores de la Lucha, will hopefully give them more chances to produce future events for fighters and fans alike. The next Lucha Libre Spectacular is set for tonight at Cicero Stadium. For Only a Game, I'm Yolanda Perdomo in Chicago.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Peter Lydotes, Ben Singer, and Josh Rogerson at NPR's New York Bureau. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you dare view Yolanda Perdomo's Lucha Libre photo gallery, or even my photos of Providence's clay tennis courts, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from 82-year-old clay court tennis player Louis Barta.
Pete Sampras is not going to challenge me anymore because he's retired.
That's right, Mr. Barta, and you're safe as far as Jimmy Connors and Pancho Gonzalez are concerned as well. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org.